Libraries, parks, and schools across the country have been hit hard by local budget crises, but until recently, police and fire departments were largely protected. Well, no more. In California, unprecedented cuts to fire station budgets are raising concerns about cities and towns' ability to respond to emergencies, especially now that wildfire season has begun. Rachel Dornhelm has the story.
In the spick-and-span kitchen of Vallejo Fire Station 27, the sweet smell of flavored coffee hangs in the air. It's 8 a.m., and Acting Captain Thomas Brew sits down at the large table after two straight days on duty. I ask if it was a busy night.
Very busy. Both nights. Yeah.
He says they're all like that these days. Over the last 3 years, as the Northern California city of Vallejo has worked through a legal bankruptcy, the fire department has shrunk almost in half, from 28 on-duty firefighters to just 15. They have closed 3 out of 8 stations, including one in the Glen Cove neighborhood, where Brew says there was a big house fire last week.
Yeah, I was on that fire. It had one house going, but the engine company that was closest there was closed. So another company had to come from farther away, and it gave the fire time to catch a second house on fire.
Brew says that kind of collateral damage is happening more and more. In cash-strapped Vallejo, they are increasingly relying on an agreement for emergency backup, known as mutual aid, with neighboring cities.
One day, we asked for mutual aid from one of the surrounding areas, and they just flat out said, we can't do it, and that was the first time that caught me a little bit off guard because that had never happened before.
Vallejo Fire Department spokesman William Tweedy.
Every jurisdiction has less funding. Their people in their city say, why are we providing services outside our city when we're not getting reimbursed for it? So those things are going to start raising their ugly head. And eventually we might not get mutual aid because they can't afford it either.
Vallejo is not the only one closing stations. Lawrence, Massachusetts has shuttered half of its firehouses. Last month, the city of San Jose laid off almost 7% of its force and closed one station. Now it has a large sign out front.
This one says, in case of emergency, call 911. Firefighters not available at the station.
That's San Jose Fire Captain Chuck Rangel.
And there are a lot of neighbors here in this community, and we've had instances where people in distress, either for a medical call or a fire, go directly to the station and start knocking on the door.
That's just what led to a tragedy earlier this summer in San Diego, when relatives brought a choking 2-year-old to the fire station down their block. The station was closed that day for budget reasons. It took 9.5 minutes for a paramedic to arrive, and the boy didn't survive. Stuart Gary consults to local governments about their fire departments. The former Bay Area fire chief says cuts and brownouts, taking engines out of service, are happening throughout the country. Gary says city managers facing shortfalls have told him the same thing.
If I closed every library, if I stopped mowing the grass in every city park, I still can't close the deficit because police and fire are in most cases 35-45% of a city's expenses, and they have to get to their public safety cost.
There's a debate over who's to blame here. Some say it's firefighters' high salaries and pensions. Others say it's disappearing tax revenue. One of the concerns in California is what would happen when mutual aid is needed for a large event like a wildfire. The California Emergency Management Agency moves resources to major disasters. Chief Kim Zagaris says in the past, along the North Coast, he could depend on getting 175 local government engines to a fire.
But during last year's fires, the most we were able to get was 125 engines.
In a statement, ISO, an insurance industry organization that rates cities' ability to respond to fires, says they have downgraded more cities this year than before. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Dornhelm.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. It's easy to say that nothing is made in the USA anymore. So many things we use in our daily lives are made in China or elsewhere. We're going to shine a light this morning on a different reality. The National Association of Manufacturers says 286,000 firms make things here in the United States. NPR's Tamara Keith visited one of those companies, a California flashlight maker called Maglite.
These are the big, heavy, black metal flashlights that police officers use, and their smaller cousin, the Mini Mag Light. They're durable, simple, sleek, and made in Ontario, California. Lynn Perry, head of customer service for Mag Instrument, says a lot of people are surprised by that.
They're amazed that we're right here. People think that this product is coming from China.
There's a reason people assume Mag Lights are made overseas. Making a mass-produced consumer good like this in Southern California defies prevailing business logic. So how? Why are they still here? Automation, bringing more and more production in-house, and having good patent attorneys is part of it. But really, it all comes down to the stubborn determination of one man, Anthony Tony Maglica.
I will not go out of the country if my life depends on it. It's no reason for it, really.
Maglica is 79 years old and still comes to work every day, often before dawn. He walks the 700,000-square-foot factory floor, checking in on every detail of production. Maglica was born into the Great Depression in New York, but he spent his formative years living in Croatia, surviving hunger and worse as World War II tore through Europe. When he returned to America and set out to start his own company, Maglica says he had just $125. What he's built is a multi-million dollar business with more than 700 employees and customers all over the world. Over the years, Maglica has worked hard to bring more production in-house, to cut out the middleman and streamline operations. So the springs that go into the flashlights used to be made by another company. Now they're made here at the Mag facility in Ontario. One thing that isn't made in the U.S. is the tiny bulb in the Mini Mag Light. And that clearly drives Maglica crazy. In the early days, all Mag Lights were assembled by hand. Now much of the work is automated. Engineers here at Mag Instrument designed and built all of the sophisticated assembly systems, says Gus Hawthorne, director of engineering.
We have to be competitive price-wise. The only way that we can do that is to automate, and that's the key to our success.
The company has never raised the wholesale price on the Mag Light. Three decades later, they cost exactly what they did in 1979.
Tony would be the first one to tell you that had this been a publicly owned company, they would have fired him. They would have thought he was nuts. Maybe he is for continuing to do it in this country when it's so difficult. But there's a lot of us in this company that are very thankful that he did that.
Maglica says people tell him all the time he could make more money if he stopped insisting on making Mag Lights in the United States. And he knows they're right. He just doesn't care. What he cares about are his employees, who he describes as family. Last year, as a result of the tough economy, Mag Instrument lost nearly $11 million. The company had to lay off 200 people. Tony Maglica says it was the saddest thing he ever had to do.
Where are those people going to go? There's no jobs. If everybody will come and tell me, Tony, we all quit because we got a wonderful job, it would be a hell of a relief on me because I won't feel responsible.
Maglica feels responsible for every one of his employees, how they're going to pay their mortgages, how they're going to pay for their kids to go to college. And it seems like more than anything, that's what drives him. Maglica is nearly 80 years old. He refuses to talk about retirement, hasn't been on a vacation since the 1990s, and is now working even longer days than normal as he designs a new product line himself. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
Perhaps your local library has recently cut its hours, or the police and fire department has had to lay off workers. This is all part of the financial crisis that is facing cities and towns across the country. But while airlines, car companies, and more than 1.5 million American families have declared bankruptcy this year, it's less common for cities to declare bankruptcy. Wall Street Journal economics editor David Wessel joins us now to explain why. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Ari.
Okay, well, we've recently heard that the capital of Pennsylvania, Harrisburg, is close to bankruptcy, and other cities as well. Does that mean that they will eventually enter bankruptcy?
Probably not. Harrisburg, actually, the city council met last night, is still trying to find a way to avoid filing for bankruptcy. Central Falls, Rhode Island, which came very close, got taken over by the state in a receivership. Jefferson County, Alabama, which has had this morass of a sewer system, debt problem. Receiver was appointed by the court. It turns out that bankruptcy, Chapter 9 of the Bankruptcy Code, the one that cities can take, isn't quite as attractive an option for debt-burdened municipalities as it is for consumers or businesses. The law doesn't solve their problems, and it's also so rarely used that the case law is unclear. Fewer than 250 of the 89,000 local governments, most of them very, very small, have filed for bankruptcy since 1980. So it's unlikely we're going to see a wave of these, although they're in the headlines constantly.
Okay, so if bankruptcy can't solve a city's financial problems, what is the solution? Is there, in fact, a problem?
Yeah, well, there is definitely a problem. It's just that bankruptcy doesn't seem the way out. So in a sense, the bigger problem is there is no clear way out for cities which have made promises essentially they can't keep. State and local governments have well over $2.4 trillion worth of debt, 35% more than they did 5 years ago when the economy was a lot healthier. And they have promised more than $3 trillion worth of health and pension benefits to their workers, and they haven't set aside nearly enough money to back up these promises. So this happens from time to time, that they have trouble meeting their obligations when the economy tanks, their revenues go down. This time, the economy isn't coming back very fast. Sales tax revenue, income tax revenue are not coming back very fast, and they're still confronted with all these promises they made before. Even though there's been a lot of tax increases by legislatures and city councils, state and local tax revenues were in the second quarter were only 1.7% higher than a year ago, this despite the fact that the recession is probably over. And so they're caught in this vice of having income that doesn't go up fast enough to take care of the promises they made.
What does that mean for me if I live in one of these cities that's close to bankruptcy that's made more promises than it can keep?
It means two things, higher taxes and worse services. There's just only two things you can do. And in many municipalities and states across the country that are in trouble, they're getting both of these things. There were more tax increases at the state level in the last fiscal year than there have been in the last 20 years.
And what does it mean for the investors who the cities owe money to?
Well, for now, most of them, all of them have been paid back with a very few exceptions. And the experts in municipal finance, the rating agencies and the bankruptcy lawyers say that it's unlikely that there'll be a wave of defaults, that cities and towns and states almost always find a way to pay off the debt holders. Of course, that's the kind of assurance we had before the financial crisis. And so there's good reason to worry that somewhere along the line, some cities or towns will actually not be able to pay their bills, pay their bondholders 100 cents on the dollar. But for now, it's important to note nearly all of them have been paid back.
Well, just briefly, any chance of a bailout for cities from states of the federal government?
Well, that would certainly make a lot of local officials happy. I think for now there's bailout fatigue. The states have their own problems, and it's unlikely to me that Washington will come to the rescue of a bunch of state and local governments that have mismanaged their affairs to tax other taxpayers or borrow lots of money to pay their obligations.
All right,
so
thanks.
Not for a while.
That's David Wessel of the Wall Street Journal and a frequent guest on Morning Edition. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro, filling in for Renee Montaigne, who's in Afghanistan.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. We're going to check in with two of the intense campaigns in this election season. In a moment, we'll hear from one of the contests that may determine control of the House. We'll start in California, where the candidates for governor debated last night. Democrat Jerry Brown, a former California governor, and Republican Meg Whitman, the former CEO of eBay, agreed on only two things. First, that California is dysfunctional, and second, that electing their opponent would continue the state's slide. Here's more from NPR's Ina Jaffe.
The California budget is 3 months overdue. Unemployment is above 12%, and most voters think the state's on the wrong track. Former eBay chief Meg Whitman says what California needs to solve its problems is some business smarts. You want to create jobs? Then improve the business climate.
We've got to examine every tax, every regulation, and say, are we competitive to neighboring states?
Whitman proposes cutting a number of taxes, including capital gains. Jerry Brown said that would punch a huge hole in the budget and called the idea a giveaway for rich people, like Whitman.
I have a very specific plan. It's not to give a $5 billion tax break to myself, much less to the billionaires and the millionaires.
Meg Whitman's fortune, estimated at more than $1 billion, has become one of the biggest stories of this race. She spent $119 million of her own money, a record for a U.S. political campaign. But she insisted she's not trying to buy the election.
Well, I have invested a lot of my own money in this campaign. But you know what? I don't think you can buy elections. I think Californians are too smart.
And spending her own money, argued Whitman, makes her independent of the special interests who usually contribute to political campaigns, like the public employee unions who've supported her opponent. But Brown insisted he'd be independent of union interests now, as he was when he served as governor 30 years ago.
As far as unions, I'm the only governor that ever vetoed the pay raises for all public employees. I did it once, I did it twice. I'll do it again if I have to.
Opinion polls show this race is a dead heat. And while the term career politician is a handicap in many campaigns this year, Jerry Brown embraces his four-decade resume. Former governor, former mayor of Oakland, currently state attorney general. To Whitman, it just means Brown's had more time than most to be corrupted by special interests.
The labor unions and Jerry Brown have been joined at the hip for 40 years. I mean, my view is putting Jerry Brown in charge of negotiating with the labor unions around pensions, around how many people we have in the state government, is like putting Count Dracula in charge of the blood bank.
As combative as the debate was, Whitman remained poised, cheerful, and always hit her talking points, whether asked about them or not. Brown was looser, with self-deprecating wit, like his response when asked if he could assure Californians that if elected, he'd focus on being governor and not run for president, as he did twice when he was governor before. The 72-year-old Brown's answer? Nah, he's too old now.
One more thing. I now have a wife. And, you know, I come home at night. I don't try to close down the bars of Sacramento like I used to do when I was governor of California. So don't worry about that. I'm in for the duration here.
Whitman was not amused. Electing Jerry Brown as governor again, she suggested, would do nothing to turn California around.
I thought Einstein had it right. The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and hoping for a different result.
But Brown warned that a business executive with no political experience is also something California voters tried before when they elected their current governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Right now, fewer than 30% of Californians think he's doing a good job. Ina Jaffe, NPR News, Davis, California.